from 6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to JJ Hartigan for keeping us entertained on this bank holiday afternoon. It is Monday, August 7th, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, Alan Cawley chats the League of Ireland title race and England shootout drama in the Women's World Cup.
It's there to be won. And this is a story. It is Chloe Kelly who scored the most famous goal in England's footballing history against Germany last summer, and the iconic celebration that followed. Can Kelly send Manchester City, send England into the World Cup quarterfinals? An unusual runoff. Oh, she's hammered it in. Ndozi may have got fingertips to it, but the power took it through, and England are through.
Yeah, it was a busy day on Saturday in rugby, so Keane Tracy is in studio to talk World Cup warm-ups, while in Camogie, Aoife Murray reflects on Cork's dominance as they lift the O'Duffy Cup for the 29th time.
All that plus National Hunt jockey Sean Flanagan on his comeback journey as we reflect on the Galway Festival with Ruby. If you want to get in touch, you can drop us a text on 51552 or tweet us at GameOn 2FM.
GameOn on 2FM.
Ruby Walsh, hello, how are you?
Hey, Shane, how are you?
I'm very well.
Good, had you a nice bank holiday Monday?
I had work filled, prepping for this evening's show, so I was, you know, Ruby.
Oh, dedication.
Working away. Working for the whole bank holiday. As were you, Ruby, Galway races, you were on duty.
Yeah,
the weekend and for the week as well, yeah.
Yeah, no, I wasn't there for the weekend. I was out of Galway on Friday evening. Don't have the salmon for 7 days anymore, Shane, but yeah, it was a great week. Crowds are up a couple of thousand for the week, so Galway were happy with that, and that's with, look, there's no point in moaning about the weather, it's the same for everybody, but you know, anything that's outdoors definitely relies on a bit of sunshine to attract the crowds.
Absolutely. What was the highlight for you?
Personally, Zarek the Brave won the Galway hurdle for Willie Mullins. I thought Paul Townend gave him a brilliant ride to win for only being a 4-year-old. I thought Ashtree Meadow was very good in the Galway hurdle under Danny Gilligan. What a performance from a 17-year-old. I mean, as Barry Geraghty said on the television, I was standing with Davy Russell himself on Thursday, and he said, I don't think any of us would have done that at 17 years of age. And I was standing there thinking, at 17 I hadn't even ridden over fences, let alone ridden in the Galway Plate. So it was an incredible achievement for a 17-year-old. And outside of that, it was just a generally good week. Great crowds, a big spread of winners across the boards. I mean, even Peter Fahey, I'm not a small trainer, but not a big trainer by any manner of means, having four winners on the week from his yard in Monastrevin. And I just thought there was a huge spread of winners and generally a good feel vibe in Galway, which good, there usually is.
Good crack. That's what Jane Mangan good was describing. Crack. I've never been, Ruby, but it's
But to be fair, like, I mean, I suppose it's a bit different because it's during the week that you're seeing Shop Street, Key Street, Air Square packed. But if you're in Galway any weekend, it's pretty similar.
No, that is true. That's true. I think the official Orty promo online had it's like Rag Week for adults. So
Rag Week, yeah.
So I would say it was good.
Hence why 5 days was enough for me.
Keane Tracy is with us as well, Ruby. Keane, before we dive into rugby chat in detail, I suppose, what was your highlight from the weekend? And it's okay if it's rugby. We can go there already.
Well, I was at the Aviva Saturday and Sunday. Saturday for work for the Ireland-Italy game, which I know we're going to talk about. And I was there on Sunday as well for the United game yesterday against Bilbao. Was that a highlight? I don't know.
You weren't one of the fans demanding refunds from Aviva for the big names not being there, no?
No, I wasn't. I actually thought you were going to say, was I one of the fans who was booing Harry Maguire yesterday, which was...
I think far more than you of that, Keane. I wouldn't pose that question to you.
Yeah, it was surreal, really, to be honest. Hearing that from an Irish crowd was embarrassing, really. I thought, like, the whole crowd were United fans. Like, it was just a sea of red in the Aviva. And, yeah, it was just strange because, you know, after it happened, like, Harry Maguire made the mistake for the goal, but after it happened, and the crowd were sincerely, it must be said, like, cheering, like, every time Harry Maguire touched the ball, it was quite demeaning, I thought. I mean, obviously, he's had a really difficult spell, but it was just a strange, strange atmosphere. So, yeah, I wasn't one of the ones complaining about it, but I wasn't overly happy either, I have to say. Now, I only paid, I think, €50 for my ticket, which is probably just on the limit of what I think yesterday was worth. You still got to see a couple of senior players. Game itself wasn't great, it has to be said, last-minute equaliser. But it was nice to be back on the sporting beat anyway, all the same.
Absolutely. Nice to attend a match, no doubt, Keane, as a fan, as opposed to
It's a real novelty to go to Aviva and not be in the press box. So, yeah, I enjoyed it from that point of view as well.
Ruby, you weren't in the VV yesterday?
No, I wasn't. How did you find the seats outside the press box, Keane? Because they're pretty much the best seats in the Aviva.
Well, that's the thing, Ruby. Like I said, my ticket was €50, so I wasn't sitting on the halfway line. Like
you're on the roof, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly where I was. Yeah, but look, you get what you pay for, but I probably had the last laugh because I didn't go for the more expensive options. Not that I knew, I have to say. I didn't know about the friendly that they were playing on Saturday as well. So, look, I live in Dublin. It's not that expensive for me to go other than paying for the ticket. But like all around me, there was mams and dads with their kids. It was a real family vibe. And if you were bringing like your whole family to it, like, and then you got that team, I can understand why people were annoyed, to be honest. But it was a bit different for me. I should say that.
Absolutely. A couple of news headlines while we're on the football topic, I suppose, as well, just before we rattle into rugby chat. If Derry City progress against Tobol Kostanay of Kazakhstan in their UEFA Europa Conference League third qualifying round contest, and they will face either Victoria Pilsen from Czechia or Gazira United from Malta in the playoff round. Interestingly, though, Derry's home leg against Tobol Kostanay could be played in Belfast. So with the Ryan McBride Brandywell Stadium not meeting UEFA requirements, Tallaght Stadium was due to host the match in a couple of weeks, but Derry have made a request today to the FAI to play in Windsor Park instead. So that will certainly will be interesting to see where they do play that one. Ireland international Harriet Scott has stepped away from football to become a doctor in the NHS. Scott graduated from her degree while in Australia with the women's national team. And finally, funny you mention Harry Maguire, Keane, I believe West Ham have put in another bid for Harry Maguire, and indeed Scott McTominay as well. Harry Maguire wasn't even captain yesterday, it was Tom Heaton, so it does seem like he will be.
Is that a downward bid they put in this time?
Yeah, possibly. Well, Spurs have also rejected it, the latest bid from Bayern Munich for Harry Kane as well, and apparently Mbappe has now told PSG he wants out, so lots to get through with Alan Colley in due course. But let's chat rugby, Ruby. Let's chat rugby, because Keane Tracy, as you mentioned, you were in the Aviva Stadium on Saturday in a working capacity as Ireland started their Rugby World Cup warm-ups with a 33 points to 17 win against Italy. Andy Farrell's side now head to Portugal for a warm weather camp before taking on England in Dublin on August 19th, and their final warm-up match is against Samoa in Bayonne on August 26th. So Andy Farrell referred to the performance, Keane, as clunky at times. What was your take on the 80 minutes plus of rugby?
Yeah, I think that's a good word to probably describe it. I think as a whole, there was plenty for Andy Farrell to get his teeth stuck into, which is exactly what he wants. I mean, these warm-up games are so tricky. Like, there's so many different guys playing for different things. I mean, a lot of the guys know that they're going to be on the plane to France at the end of the month, barring injury. And then other guys are basically playing for the last probably 2 to 3 spots, you'd say, at most, that are probably available. Again,
is that all? I think so.
I mean, you have to remember the position that Ireland are starting from. I mean, they're Grand Slam champions. They're not like England and Wales and Australia, who are scrambling around kind of last minute trying to put things together. I mean, Andy Farrell has built this squad over the last 4 years, so it makes sense that there would be so few positions up for grabs. Now, as we know, that can change really quickly with injuries, with suspensions. Look at Scotland at the weekend with Andrew Fagerson getting sent off. He might get a ban, so that could impact their World Cup preparations as well. And obviously, they're going to play Ireland at the pool stages. So it wasn't perfect by any means, but I don't think anyone was expecting it to be perfect. I don't think Andy Farrell would necessarily want it to be perfect as a first pre-season hit out. You also have this kind of like a bit of shadow boxing that like Ireland aren't going to show their full hand in any of these games in terms of running particular moves and stuff. It was interesting. You know, they got a couple of 5 metre penalties and they just tapped and went, whereas like come the World Cup when they're playing a South Africa or Scotland, I fully expect them to have some sort of pre-planned moves, but they're not going to show them in these games. So the first half was pretty good. There was lots of good stuff for a first season hit out in that. Caelan Dyer played at open side, which was interesting. He started at open side for Leinster against Leicester in the Champions Cup quarter final last season, but only actually played there for about 20 minutes because Ryan Baird got injured, so they had to reshuffle the back line. And then, as luck would have it, a similar kind of thing happened on Saturday because Jack Conan went off injured, which meant that Caelan Dyer had to go back to number 8. But for the 35 minutes or so that Dyer did play open side, he played very well. I mean, he's just a supremely talented athlete, the kind of guy who you could put him in any position on the pitch and he would genuinely do a good job for you. I still think, personally, I don't think there's any doubt that number 8 is his best position. I think in Ireland's first choice back row, he is still going to be number 8. But from Andy Farrell's point of view, I can understand why he did it, because when you look through the squad, there's no natural backup to Josh van der Fleer, who's the obvious starting open side. So Peter O'Mahony can do a job there. He's far more effective, I would say, at blind side. So it made sense that he wanted to, you know, put Doris there just in case that he needs it come the World Cup. And for the 35 minutes, like I said, that he played there, he was very, very good. So not quite as impressive from a team point of view in the second half. Lacked a bit of cohesion, I thought, when Craig Casey and Jack Crowley moved out of half-back. I thought they lost a little bit of control. Again, bound to happen. But for some guys, like, that possibly was their last chance to impress before Andy Farrell is going to name his squad at the end of the month. So, like you said, Shane, they're gone off to Portugal now for a warm weather training camp for the week. So I think there'll be plenty to get stuck into from a coaching point of view.
Kane, you said there's only a couple of places up for grabs. What are they? Who are they?
I think there's probably a space in the back three. So it depends, Ruby, on what kind of makeup that Andy Farrell goes for in his squad. And I know we get on to talk about this because England and the All Blacks have named their squads today. But like, will Andy Farrell go for 19 forwards and 14 backs like England have done? Or will he go like the All Blacks approach, which would be the more traditional approach, 18 forwards and 15 backs? My gut would tell me that it will be 18 forwards and 15 backs. I just think there's a better balance to that. So I think there's probably a spot in the back three. I know Jimmy O'Brien went off injured at the weekend, but to me, he's pretty nailed on. I would say he just covers so many positions really well. I think to me, it looks like a bit of a shootout between Keith Earls and Jacob Stockdale for that kind of one remaining spot in the back three. They both did a lot of things well at the weekend, but they won't want to see back replays of Italy's tries that they were involved in. Jacob Stockdale missed a really poor tackle out wide, which, you know, for all the good things that he had done in the game, and there were plenty of them, it must be said, he looked really fit, he looked really sharp. That's been his Achilles heel over the years. I don't think that's going to reflect well when it comes down to it. But then Keith Earls shifted into outside centre and it was all going well until the very end when Italy scored a try and he got ran over, really missed a poor tackle as well, you'd have to say, for an Italian try. So I think they're probably in a bit of a shootout. I think Keith Earls is probably just about ahead, purely on experience, leadership, his versatility, what he brings. I think a guy like Stuart McCloskey, he did well enough, I think, at the weekend. He scored a try. But will Ireland bring, you know, four centres? They brought four centres to the last World Cup. That's a bit up for debate. And then you look at the forwards, there's definitely, I think, a position up for grabs in the second row. I thought Joe McCarthy was excellent for Ireland at the weekend alongside Ian Henderson in the second row. By far his, I know he's only played a couple of games, but even for the games he played for Leinster, it was by far his best game. Looked really mature, really used his size. And to me, he's probably in a bit of a battle maybe with Kieran Treadwell, the Ulster second row, who was outstanding for Ireland on last summer's tour. So they're kind of the areas, I think, the 2 to 3 spots are up for grabs. But like I said, so much can change, because I think we're going to see pretty close to Ireland's first choice team play against England on Saturday week in Dublin. And I mean, like, again, you're only an injury or suspension away from the best laid plans being ripped up, as Ireland know only too well, I think, from throughout last year's this Six Nations just gone.
You're talking there about, will you bring four centres or not? What about out half? At the moment, there's four lads in that panel or squad as it is: Frawley, Crowley, Ross Byrne, and Johnny Sexton. What? Who misses out there?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they view Frawley. And at the weekend, I thought it was quite telling that when Jimmy O'Brien went off injured, they put Kieran Frawley into out half at halftime for his debut and put Jack Crowley back to fullback. Now, there's a couple of different ways you can look at that. The way I look at it is, Andy Farrell was quite happy with the 40 minutes that he got out of Jack Crowley, and he thought another 40 minutes at fullback, like, that's another string to his bow. He's played there the odd time for Munster. He's played at 12. So he can provide that cover that Frawley does as well. Frawley is playing a little bit of catch-up purely because he's been injured so often. He definitely would have made his debut last November, probably in that Fiji game, but he picked up an injury. And that's been kind of the story of his kind of last year, you'd have to say. So he's been really unlucky. I think Jimmy O'Brien, like I mentioned, is going to go as that kind of utility, versatile player. So maybe himself and Kieran Frawley are kind of up against each other more so than Kieran Frawley against a Ross Byrne or a Jack Crowley. Obviously, Johnny Sexton is going. And at the moment, I think your three out halves are Johnny Sexton, Jack Crowley and Ross Byrne. And, you know, if you were picking an Ireland team tomorrow and if Johnny Sexton's ban was over, which it will be come the World Cup, I think Jack Crowley is probably just edged slightly ahead, not just on what we saw on Saturday, which I thought was a lot of good stuff. Not perfect by any means, but for the way he finished the season with Munster and helping them win the URC title, I just think he's in a bit of better form than Ross Byrne. But Ross Byrne is almost certainly going to start against England in a couple of weeks, and that'll be a massive opportunity. A little bit of pressure on him now, I think, to respond to what Crowley did at the weekend. But it's definitely, it's a healthy place to be in for sure. I mean, they're both nowhere near obviously experienced as Johnny Sexton, but there's a lot of encouraging things I think we're seeing, particularly from Jack Crowley.
On the topic of out half, and you mentioned Ireland are in Portugal on a warm weather training camp. Now, there's been a few comments on social media. You might be able to put some manners on this. So Ireland are in Portugal, warm weather training camp. Johnny Sexton is currently serving a ban. However, he may feature in a training match that isn't a match, that could possibly be a match against the Portugal national team.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? look, my understanding is that this has been arranged for a while. Like, we don't have absolute clarity in terms of what the match entails. It could just be a case of Portugal coming into camp and the backs running against the backs and then the packs scrummaging against each other just for mutual beneficial reasons. Like, there's no one, the RFU haven't come out and said that Ireland are playing an 80-minute, like, no-holds-barred game at the weekend, so or during the week. So we don't actually know for sure what it is. But what is in no doubt is that Johnny Sexton is going to get some sort of a hit out in training. And I've seen people online, or, you know, the conspiracy theories, which always seem to centre around Johnny Sexton, or that, like, the RFU have magicked up this, you know, friendly behind closed doors friendly. But I don't think that's the case. Like, they were always going to Portugal. That's always been a key part of their preparation, even throughout Six Nations campaign. So I think the Portuguese national team, who were going to the World Cup, had always been invited in to, you know, take part in a session. Because if you think about it, a lot of the nations going to the World Cup have four World Cup warm-up games. Ireland only have three. Again, they felt like they were starting from a good base. You think of the Southern Hemisphere teams who were coming in on the back of the Rugby Championship. So I think this was Ireland's way of having just another hit out. Again, we don't know if it's a full game, if it's just backs running against backs. So it'll be interesting. But if anyone thinks like a hit out like that is going to get Johnny Sexton up to speed for a World Cup game, I know, like, he'll probably start in that Romania game, which wouldn't have been the plan, the opener on September 9th, but it's very different, isn't it? Like, behind closed doors, just running against a training game. And I'd imagine a lot of the training sessions that Ireland are doing anyway against each other, such as a nature competition, that he's getting really good reps in training anyway. So probably much ado about nothing. Like I said, I've seen the conspiracy theories online, but a pinch of salt, I think.
There's no media over there, Kane. You know what I mean? So get the tinfoil hats out.
I don't know why not we're that there, Shane. I mean, we could do a bit of warm weather training ourselves, I think.
I think we all could. Kane, where would you stand? Three games or four games? Looking at Jack Conlon and Jimmy O'Brien. Jack hobbling around in a boot in the Aviva. Jimmy O'Brien there trying to nurse a shoulder. Even Jack Crowley wobbling or walking off holding his ribs. Where do you stand on three versus four warm-up games in such a physical sport as rugby?
Yeah, I think three is plenty. Absolutely. And I'm not even the one playing it. I was writing a piece in last Saturday's paper about this. Like, if you look back over the last four to five World Cups that Ireland have been in, the warm-up games have been carnage, like, for a lot of times. You think back to 2019, Joey Carberry did his ankle against Italy, ended up going to the World Cup, was clearly not fit, and he's never really been the same player since. You go back to 2015, Tommy O'Donnell dislocated his hip, Felix Jones got injured, David Wallace did his knee in 2011. In 2007, you had Brian O'Driscoll in the Battle of Bayonne, which I'm sure all the listeners are fully aware of. And then in 2003, Jordan Murphy broke his leg, all in warm-up games. So, Ruby, I think Andy Farrell and his coaching staff, they didn't sound overly concerned. He didn't sound overly concerned about any of the three injuries that you mentioned there. Craig Casey was another one. But obviously, anytime you see someone in a moon boot, I know it's a lot of it is precaution, but it's not a good sign. And it was telling that they got Jack Conlon off after only 35 minutes. So I think we're due a squad update tomorrow from the RFU. So we'll have much more clarity, I think, around them then.
Well, I never saw someone put one on because they couldn't find their other shoe.
It's true, yeah. It was, yeah, he did walk off though, Jack Conan. Like, you were kind of struggling to see what had actually happened in terms of the injury. So he got treatment very briefly and he did walk off. And even on the pitch at the end, he was still there walking around. So, like, he's a guy who ended up in a moon boot at the 2019 World Cup after the first game. And we were only talking to him about this last week. Like, he had his World Cup ended. He came on in the first game against Scotland in Japan, was supposed to start in the second game, and did an injury that cost him 6 months out of the game. So you'd really hope that it's not going to be serious. So we're keeping our fingers crossed for sure.
Absolutely. For all people. You want all players to be fit, but for Jack in particular. Is this the best prepared Ireland have been going into a World Cup?
Oh, it's funny, like Andy Farrell hit the nail on the head kind of about this last week, that, you know, pre-season is going really well, but if you were to sit in any team's press conference, like most of them are going to tell you that pre-season...
But they're really egging it up. Like, I mean, the players who were out in media, it was Ty Byrne and Craig Casey. Mm. I think Craig Casey said, yeah, I was talking to a few of the lads, it's been different to other pre-seasons, it's not like barbaric running into the ground,
was the word
he used, and that it's more skill-focused, they've had the guts of 6 weeks together and now we have the match. I mean...
Look, it sounds like everything that you're hearing, not just publicly, but even behind the scenes, that pre-season has been going well. But I've never heard someone saying at the time pre-season isn't going well. It's been interesting that, you know, Paul O'Connell was very good on this last week. I know you were there as well, Shane, saying that they're doing a lot more kind of rugby focused and not kind of running the players into the ground. They're also not doing kind of the mad stuff that Wales have been doing, these kind of, you know, crazy training camps where there's waterboarding allegedly involved and all this. So it's been much more rugby focused, which is a good thing. I think, you know, one of the things about Andy Farrell coming in, taking over from Joe Schmidt, was like he saw what didn't work in 2019. I think they got a little bit kind of obsessed maybe with the humidity that was going to be ahead in Japan. A guy like Jason Cowman is the head of strength and conditioning. He was also there in 2019. So I think they've learned their lessons from 4 years ago. But like, look, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, pre-season's going well, but we'll see when it comes to the business end of the World Cup and that pool stage whether pre-season actually did go well, because we're not going to find that out for a while, are we?
But Kane, you're talking about lads that had, what, 3 weeks off between the end of the season before they went to Irish camp?
Yeah, three weeks where they all got married, it seems. But yeah, like...
What did they lose, like, fitness-wise? How far back can anybody go in 3 weeks? Like, pre-season, what? It's blowing the cobwebs off, surely.
Yeah, well, especially in this day and age. I mean, they're just so finely tuned. And even, I think, was it Andy Farrell or one of the coaches was telling us, like, even during the Six Nations, that even when the players go on holidays nowadays, that they're looking to make sure they book into, like, a place where it actually has training facilities and stuff. So that's why loads of them end up going to where they're actually going this weekend in Portugal, in the Algarve, because it has the facilities. Lots of them go away on holidays together so that they can make sure they're still on top of it. So I think the days of professional players coming back in any way overweight, particularly in or unfit, out of shape, particularly in a World Cup year, are few and far between, really. So,
okay, so we're going to win the World Cup, basically.
No.
We have the Munster lads coming in off the back of a URC win. We have a small little gap there where lads are still in peak fitness. We've beaten Italy. We're off to Portugal now. Warm weather training camp. Grand Slam champions. I know I'm probably tongue-in-cheek there, but on a more serious note, is there a case of managing expectations within the group and for Andy Farrell and the management team just to kind of put a lid on things and focus at the job at hand?
I think they're a very measured group anyway. What I've liked is from the last kind of couple of years, particularly even going back to the New Zealand tour last year, like the way they added the extra two midweek Maori games, like everything has been built towards the World Cup, and that's been the case in previous World Cup cycles, but the World Cup has been banned, you know, it's like next game focus. So Ireland haven't shied away from it. Andy Farrell touched on this after the game on Saturday as well, that of course they're going into the World Cup to win it. I mean, it's almost a stupid question, because what team, you know, realistically doesn't go into a World Cup if you have realistic expectations of winning it, doesn't go into, like, Ireland for every World Cup they've been in have gone in there, you know. But obviously as Grand Slam champions, you know, they have a right to feel confident. But I mean, this, by the time the World Cup starts, it'll have been 6 months since the Six Nations. We've seen the Rugby Championship going on at the moment. You see how well New Zealand are playing now. Like, they've found their mojo again. So, like, so much can still happen, I think, between now and when we get there. Like, you have the likes of Wales and England are trying to play themselves back into form. So, look, Ireland will go to France full of confidence, but that doesn't count for much unless they're able to get the job done. You know, I mean, they start with Romania, they should get through that, onto Tonga, then South Africa, then Scotland. So it's a very tough pool. And then if they get through it, which they should, without being arrogant, without being cocky, Ireland should get through that pool. They're going to play New Zealand or France in a quarter final. So, I mean, pick your poison, really. So for all that, this is probably, I would say, Ireland's best squad that they will, again, touch wood, that everyone gets their fit. Probably their best squad. It's also the strongest draw. So it kind of balances it, doesn't it?
Plenty of all that opposition were in action at the weekend as well, Keane. And England and Wales are trying to play themselves into form. Wales might have, but what kind of a mess are England in?
Yeah, and England obviously have named their World Cup squad today as well. And like I mentioned earlier, they went from 19-14 splits, so 19 forwards, 14 backs. And yeah, like, you can see them, they're clearly scrambling around trying to find different combinations, different players. I suppose the big omissions were Henry Slade and Alex Dombrandt. I think for me, Henry Slade is definitely a bigger surprise than Alex Dombrandt, who has been playing really well for Harlequins in the Premiership, but there's an element of a flat track bully, I think, about him. He's never convinced me at Test rugby at all. And despite the fact that he's been playing, I think he featured in every game that Borthwick has overseen since he's come in as head coach. Mm. And then to just drop him now doesn't really make much sense. They've only picked one specialist, number eight, in Billy Vunipola, who's best days, you say, are behind him. He's quite injury prone. They've left a guy like Henry Slade out, who's been really important, can play several different positions. So yeah, England are in a bit of a muddle, I think. Obviously, Ireland are going to play them on Saturday week. We'll get a better look at them then. But I have to say, I've just found the Steve Borthwick reign so far utterly unconvincing. I find it so uninspiring, unconvincing. They're on a good side of the World Cup draw, is the one thing that you'd say for them. So
is that nearly like the opposite of Ireland? Ireland may be the best prepared, really tough draw. Like, England, least prepared, decent draw.
And he's under a bit of pressure, I think, already, because the rugby that they've been playing has not been good. It hasn't been winning rugby, but it hasn't been good to watch either. And this was always kind of my kind of issue with Steve Borthwick taking over. He's from the Eddie Jones like school of thought, and like England, a lot of England fans were delighted when Eddie Jones left, but you kind of have a bit of Eddie Jones light coming in here in Steve Borthwick. So except without the kind of the gas press conferences that come with it, which are, you know, mostly entertaining. But yeah, look, you could have a bizarre scenario where Ireland, say, lose in a World Cup quarterfinal to an outstanding France or New Zealand team, and then someone like England could get to a semi-final. Because the draw is so lopsided, I think you're going to have a fairly average team are going to get to the last four of the World Cup, which is just a conversation for another day in terms of like making the draw for the World Cup so far out. But it's mad, really. So yeah, just go back to your original point, Ruby. Yeah, I wouldn't be confident about England's hopes at all, and particularly from what we saw against Wales and Cardiff at the weekend, they just look a bit rudderless.
How much can you read into those results with England comprehensively losing out to Wales, and indeed Scotland turning around, second half comeback against France? Strong Scotland team, bit of a weak France team, fair to say.
Yeah, and like the Scots celebrations at the end, I mean, they were really enjoying the win. Now, it was a great win and all that, and particularly because they went down to 14 men, like I mentioned earlier. Mm. Xander Fagerson got sent off, and I think his hearing might be tomorrow, so there'll be a lot of people tuning into that. Look, it was a scratch French team. If anything, it just highlighted the strength and depth that France have. Scotland did very well to come back and win it, but they weren't overly convincing. They were very poor in the first half, came back much better in the second half. But I think there was an element of France just ran out of steam, really. They just forgot to come out and play in the second half. So, look, you can be sure come that World Cup pool game, which Ireland are going to play Scotland last, in France, you'll have the usual conversations around a lot of people hyping up Scotland, and maybe they will turn around, but ultimately they generally flatter to deceive when the pressure's on, particularly against Ireland. Like, you think back to the Six Nations game just gone in Murrayfield, everything that went wrong for Ireland, you know, everything that could have went wrong did go wrong for Ireland, but they still managed to come away with a win. So they'll always be tricky opponents, but sometimes we have a tendency, I think, to overhype them. And the way they were celebrating at the weekend, like I said, beating a second string French team, maybe just shows you where their mindset is, which I know is a bit harsh. Sorry, Danny Scottish.
No, listen, it's true.
Truth always hurts. As Eddie Jones found a bit of flair in Australia after a woeful rugby championship, hammered by South Africa, beaten by Argentina at home, and then trashed by New Zealand. Ireland, at least at the weekend, was only 3 points.
Yeah, I mean, they're another team scratching around looking for their form as well. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to get a read, I think, on Australia. Even the All Blacks had made a few changes at the weekend and they still came good. So it's interesting, isn't it? Like, you have New Zealand, South Africa, Argentina and Australia coming into the World Cup, as it is always is the case, on the back of a rugby championship. So it kind of goes back to the question Ruby was asking earlier, you know, would you want 3 or 4 warm-up games? Look at the Southern Hemisphere teams who are coming in on the back of a really competitive and intense rugby championship. So I don't know, which would you prefer? Andy Farrell again was speaking about this last week and has said even when he was a player playing rugby league, he always thought it was weighted towards the Southern Hemisphere teams in terms of coming in that battle hardened. But I suppose you can look at it two ways again, like Ruby kind of touched on, that if you pick up injuries in the rugby championship, come in. But the New Zealand squad was named overnight as well and they don't have too many injury concerns. I know Brodie Retallick was, but he's named in the squad, not really a surprise at all. So they've come out of it in really good health, and like I said, compare this to this time last year. Like, I was over in New Zealand, they were getting slaughtered after Ireland publicly in terms of the newspapers, on the news, all different kinds of shows. I mean, rugby is obviously a religion over there, but like, in the space of 12 months, it's been flipped, and now like the All Blacks are back. Joe Smith, you can really see, has got his teeth into them, and his I think his imprint is all over the way they're playing. So they're going to be very, very dangerous opponents. I can't wait to see that opening game against France.
Yeah, I was going to actually ask you about Joe. How influential do you think he has been, and how influential will he be now going forward for New Zealand?
Oh, I think he's, like I said, I think his stamp is all over the team, particularly in the Bledisloe Cup game a couple of weeks ago. Just the way New Zealand went after Australia in the air with their kicking game and stuff, it was like real copy and paste template from what Ireland did when they were so successful in 2018. So obviously it's a strange scenario there in New Zealand, with Ian Foster is going to be gone at the end of the World Cup with Scott Robertson coming in. But I think Joe Schmidt had committed to being part of that All Blacks kind of World Cup setup, you knew he wasn't going in there. Okay, he's not sure, is it senior coach, maybe is his official title, but Joe Schmidt was never going to be going in there taking a backward step and not having his voice heard. So yeah, the All Blacks are going to be, as they always are, come every World Cup, very dangerous opponents, and Ireland could meet them in the quarter final.
If we were to meet them in the quarter final, is there a small chance a lot of the Irish players will know the Joe Schmidt template?
Possibly. And I think the biggest thing though is the fear factor is well and truly gone from the All Blacks now. But I remember 4 years ago going into the quarter final against New Zealand, I genuinely thought Ireland were going to do it, and they were obliterated in Tokyo, absolutely hammered. But going to New Zealand last summer and winning the first game on New Zealand soil, which was huge, but then backing it up and winning a series, I don't think the aura is, you know, and obviously Ireland have beaten them several times at home. They beat them in Chicago. So I don't think it's the fear factor is what it was. But again, New Zealand are, you know, their stock and trade is peaking at World Cups. It's the one thing that Ireland haven't done for eternity. So they might know Joe Schmidt's game plan, Ruby, but I mean, how often did we see when Joe Schmidt was in charge of Ireland that he had something up his sleeve? And it'd be a fascinating game if it did come to pass, but you could be sure Joe Schmidt would know the Irish game plan as well.
Absolutely. Take that fear factor out. Do a Matt Williams. Call them New Zealand. Ban the word All Blacks. That's what it's all about. Keane Tracy from the Irish Independent, thank you very much for popping into the studio. Much appreciated. Ruby, we've lots more to get through this evening. We've Camogie, we've soccer, and we'll be chatting to National Hunt Jockey Sean Flanagan. Stay with us here on Game On 2FM.
Game On.
Camogie.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On as we chat Camogie in the company of former Cork star and indeed regular Game On pundit Aoife Murray. Aoife, thanks very much for taking the call, because we are, of course, reflecting on Cork's 29th All-Ireland title. First and foremost, where are the celebrations? Are they still ongoing for yourself, Aoife?
I leave that to the players. I wasn't much good at it now myself as a player, you know. I think, in fairness, watching them today and last night, I don't think they need a whole lot of help celebrating either. Delighted to see that they're just absolutely making the most of it. It's great to see some of the videos of them celebrating and just really, really taking in the moment. So, absolutely delighted for them.
Yeah, homecoming is ongoing. I think they were on the train at 3 o'clock this evening, I'm right in saying, I think.
So they were, yeah. I think they're back in the mall now at the moment. So, okay. which is one of the which was a great moment for them on a Monday evening. I think they're heading up to Amy's club, St. Vincent's, then thereafter, which look it'd be a massive proud night for that club. I think it'll be a great one for the future players to come out of that club to see the captain back there with the cup.
It most certainly will. And Aoife, on the broader scale, a crowd of over 30,000 in Croke Park yesterday for the Camogie final, that's a huge number and a step in the right direction too.
It is, and I would hope, Ruby, now that's the baseline, isn't it? You know, this is what we need to keep on building on for not only the years to come, but I'm quite passionate about not just getting 30,000+ for the finals, but can we get 20,000+ for the semi-finals and quarter-finals and so on? You know, we built 7,500 there for the semi-final in Nolan Park. I would have loved to have seen that at 15,000 if we can get 30 in the All-Ireland. So massive step forward, but hopefully now it's very much the baseline and the expectation going forward that we should be having those numbers at our big days.
I know many a racecourse that would absolutely give the right arm for 30,000 people, that I would guarantee you. So I'm glad it's your baseline. This is it's an incredible number. But look, as a game, it was very much one-sided. Cork were dominant from the start. I probably, as a neutral, felt slightly sorry for Waterford because nothing seemed to go right for them. But the other side of that is, as a professional, Cork gave them no chance for anything to go right today.
Yeah, true. And I think even looking back on it, like even trying to break the game down into moments, because look, you could read the stats and the stats just point to one thing, or it doesn't really reflect the game, does it? You know, and I think when you look back 3 minutes in, Waterford were dealt with probably one of the toughest blows that they could, with Vicky Faulkner having to go off. And sure, after being given that big job of marking Amy O'Connor, Ruby, I think was probably just the start of that bad luck. But I think they always say you make your own luck, and in Northern Finals, I think looking at how Cork just were so ruthless, and I think they were ruthless from start to finish. You know, even seeing Libby Coppinger getting a yellow card there, it was at 37 minutes. You know, there was no way a Waterford player was going to get in on goals in the second half. And I can't remember what the exact score was, but it just, to me, I think Ruby showed the ruthlessness from first minute to last second. But I think for Waterford, Vicky going off was probably the biggest blow. They brought on Heffernan, two completely different players, and a very different player than what would need to be on Amy O'Connor. And I think for me, Cork had the difference, which was the bench, but also it was the impact of those starters versus Waterford. To me, if Amy O'Connor was a star in the second half of the forwards, Sorkin McCartan was absolutely outstanding in that first half. I think what she really showed was, what do you need to win in All-Ireland? The correct attitude and absolute and 100% work rate. She was outstanding that first half, and a big stepping stone to the win. For me, Waterford, every time they tried to do something, it just was not working. And even thinking of the efforts, you know, the efforts or the opportunities, I should say, Cork got 78% of them, Waterford were about 42%. So I think, in fairness, Ruby, they got their opportunities, but maybe that big day, losing Vicky at the start, and really only having Lorraine Bray and Carton kind of trying, I think it just showed maybe one thing for Sean Power, really, for next year, is the bench. For Waterford to make a big impact next year, they have to focus on getting more bodies that they can bring off the bench to be more influential in the game.
Well, they are having success at underage, so maybe that bench will come. But you mentioned correct attitude, and every time you looked at the screen, there was 3-4 red jerseys chasing this litter in every direction. The attitude was outstanding.
100%, and I think there was a moment in the first half. I can't remember exactly what part was it, kind of just between the first and second quarter, that middle bit, where I think Laura Tracy did she won a turnover, and you would have thought she it was the final whistle, the way she celebrated that turnover, you know. And it was like the biggest fist pump that you could see. And to me, watching it, and I was like, God, they are so fired up. And I think that winning those turnovers, like you'd see it now in rugby, don't you? Once they kind of get into a turnover, a ruck situation, they celebrate it like it's the score. And I think you could really see that hunger. And I think that, for me, that moment in that first half really epitomised the attitude that was out there yesterday.
On that mental, I suppose, resilient and attitude as well. I know Matthew Toomey said past heartache drove Cork on, falling at the final hurdle in the past two seasons. Like, how big of a win is this for Cork Camogie to be? Listen, we know they're on the top of the Roll of Honour list, but to be back as All-Ireland champions now for the first time since 2018.
I think it's important for, I suppose, some of those players that were back playing there in you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, all the way up. And I think a lot of those players probably felt a huge pressure as well, Shane, that they didn't want to be the team not to win the next All-Ireland. So seeing the likes, as I said, of Laura Tracy, the two Mackies, Amy O'Connor, Ashton Thompson, Hannah Libby, Amy Lee, etc. I think I probably felt the most for those players that had been there for 10 plus years, because I think there was such a huge pressure on them to make sure that they were the women that brought the O'Duffy back to Cork again. So for me, it was probably a massive, massive win for those players. We've obviously got a lot of minors coming up, and it just keeps that continuity, you know, of, no, our senior team are winning, they are winning the All-Irelands, and not just, they're not just in the final hurdle, but they're actually there getting over the line first. So I think for the continuity of success, it was a pretty big win yesterday.
You mentioned a handful of names there, and I know we touched on Captain Amy O'Connor as well, but I do just have to pose a question on her. I mean, like, a hat-trick in 2 minutes at the start of the second half, I can't remember any more better individual performances, and even just in that short period of time in an All-Ireland final. I mean, how do you describe her contribution?
Yeah, it's really, really hard, right? Because in fairness, Vicky going off those first couple of minutes was probably a big twist in that game. In particularly, look, you have to get a certain type of player, Shane, to mark the class of Amy O'Connor, right? And I think Waterford didn't have a second Vicky to bring on. And I think that opened up the game, especially in the second half. And I think actually if you watch Amy's goals, especially if your kids out there, boys and girls, watching how she actually moved around inside that 21 to make sure that, you know, she moved to the ball and away from it, so that when Mackie was coming straight through, her player had to go, right? So once our player had to go, Amy had positioned herself perfectly. And I think that's the big thing with Amy's goals yesterday, I would say, is actually watch her movement and positioning. And I think that was probably one of the best things about not only the fact that she's captain and scores a hat-trick, but actually just watching how her movement, and the likes of Katrina Mackey, who has been there, I think, since 2009, and rather than trying to get the score herself, her ability to draw three of those players and then to have the likes of Amy O'Connor to pop the ball out in space. To me, it was great strength from Mackey as well, with regard to running through that centre and opening up that space. But then you've got Amy, who's a finisher. So, look, there's not a whole lot more I could actually say about Amy. I was delighted for her yesterday, being captain, big pressure, different type of pressure, I should say, and to come away with a hat-trick at some feet.
And that movement was very obvious last night when you watched the Sunday game, and the panel were highlighting, you could see Amy O'Connor's movement. But if you're talking about attitude and to inspire people or fellow or other players playing the game, I must say, to watch Beth Carton halfway through the second half with the last point she got when Waterford were out of it, that skill level and desire to keep trying, I've huge admiration for that as well. The skill was incredible.
100%, Ruby. And I think actually I was even looking at just some notes that I was taking down yesterday, and all I could keep on going was how Carton kept showing up, right? Like, even though it wasn't necessarily working out for her on the finishing side of things, but she kept on showing up. And I think as a leader, that sometimes, Ruby, that's all you can do, is just show up for your teammates. And she kept on trying to the very end. I know she had Lorraine Bray there as well, doing the same type of real hard work rate, but they really didn't have a huge amount of other players who kept on showing up from you know, second zero to the 60-plus minute. And in an odd way, this sounds probably really odd now, because it was obviously quite a delta in what they scored versus what Cork scored. But to me, it was great to see her in Croke Park. It was great to get for people to see just the quality of player that she is and those skills that you just mentioned. I do think, hopefully, for the future, and as you said, those minor teams that are coming up from Waterford, they got to see the likes of Beck Carton in Croke Park constantly showing up. And if that attitude and character can be filtered down to the underage, you know, they'll be certainly on that upswing curve.
Well, on the topic of the future, when the likes of Kilkenny, Galway, even Tipperary, like, they'll no doubt be watching on yesterday, looking at how Cork celebrated, how much joy it brought them, and it's going to make for some championship next year.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it was great. Like, it was great to see, you know, okay, we got, it was our 29th All-Ireland, but the girls celebrated, there like it was their first one. Like, they've never experienced this before. And I think that's the beauty of sport is, you're so fixated on the next game that actually when you do get over that final hurdle and over the line first, to me, you do feel like you've never experienced it before. And I think that can filter, you know, it's like a ripple effect, isn't it? I think that can filter down into the clubs even now in Cork, and seeing their senior team being so successful and celebrate it so emotionally. And I think then if you're like the likes of, especially the likes of Tip, who in fairness, to me, were probably a team that was just pipped out of it in the semi-final by Waterford. I think if you're Tipperary in particular, outside of Galway and Kilkenny, you would be looking at this going, you know, we have an opportunity here. We just need to fix a few little tweaks or tweak a few little things. But certainly, I think it might give that chasing pack huge amount of inspiration for next year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, I want to get your thoughts as well, Aoife, on the intermediate final, because an Aoife Minogue inspired performance inspired Meath to come back against Derry, and they'll have to do it all again next week in Clonus. What did you make of that final, and indeed who do you fancy for the replay from what you saw yesterday?
Yeah, look, it goes back to the cliche, isn't it? A game of two halves. Because it really is like the first half, Derry were out of the traps and it looked like there was no catching them, really, wasn't, you know. And then they came back slowly but surely. But to me, I think if Derry can put 45 minutes plus minutes together, they should be there, thereabouts. But I called Derry last week, but actually yesterday, it's a hard one to call. You know, Meath could take it by a couple of points, but if Derry can put 45 plus minutes together, you know, they should be thereabouts.
That'll be in Clonus next weekend. Would that be a big difference for Derry or Meath, Clonus versus Croke Park?
No, because I suppose the one thing is you wouldn't want to be going back to Croke Park to only have a couple of thousand people there. And I think bringing it to Clonus, it is middle ground. If they can get a good crowd there, there should be a huge amount of enthusiasm in the crowd. So, look, you'd love to be winning an All-Ireland in Croke Park, absolutely. But I think if you're Meath or Derry, you'll take Clonus with a good crowd halfways. And all you want to do is get over the line, whether it's in the backfield or Croke Park. All you want to do is win the All-Ireland.
Absolutely. Clare did win in All-Ireland, a junior final. They recovered from an atrocious start and a 6-point deficit to defeat Tip in the early match on Sunday. A deserved win for the banner, Aoife?
Yeah, I think so. I think just even watching them, I think physically they were just the stronger players. I think stronger from 1 to 15 and even the girls that came on. So for me, I do think it was a justified winner. I think fitness-wise and skill. And actually, in fairness, when you're watching the junior intermediate, I actually have to say I thought that final was really, really nearly just a small bit more entertaining than the intermediate. And I thought even skill level, fitness level, there wasn't a huge amount between those two levels, junior to intermediate. So for me, I thought Clare were justified winners. And it's a good chance then for their senior team. If they can get a couple of those players to come up, it should mean that hopefully they'll be a bit more competitive in the senior championship then next year.
Aoife, on topic but slightly off topic, I was listening to Hannah Looney last night talking about all the decisions she had to make through the year, clashes between camogie mm-hmm. and football and the choices she had to make. Can you see a common ground reached between the Football and the Camogie Association to allow stars such as Hannah Looney and all the names she mentioned to play both?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a difficult one, Ruby. Can I see it? Of course I can see it just out of sheer optimism, right, and hope that it's an easy win for next year, or an easy fix at the very least next year is for Camogie and Ladies Football to sit across the table and actually have a Masters fixtures list between both, have set days, a Saturday or a Sunday. And even though that's still quite taxing on the dual players, Ruby, it has to be a decision made as well by the dual players of are they able to sustain this? But certainly a joint master fixtures list between Camogie and the ladies football would agreed plan A's, B's and C's to certain scenarios. Often what's used is, oh, look, the TG Cahir want to show it on a Saturday. I think we need a bit more information around that with regard to the LGFA's relationship there, with regard to changing that, the ability to change that to a Sunday if the Camogie had already set a Camogie match for that Saturday. So look, out of sheer optimism and hope, for me, a Masters fixtures list, full agreement on scenario planning, scenario setting, and at least making the environment the best possible environment for dual players to still play both codes.
I think it's one of the beauties of the women's game that's gone from the men's game. I can remember Teddy McCarthy being a dual player. There are no more male dual players. I think it's a shame that there can't be more dual women players. I think it's something that must happen.
Yeah, 100%. And I actually think they're unbelievable athletes as well, really, to be able to play it. Because even look, you're going from a big ball to a small ball in the space of 24 hours, like, to try and trick your mind back into a size 4 slitter versus a ladies' football, you know, that is a massive physical difference in both games. So even being able to adjust to the rules, like mentally to be able to adjust to the rules is a talent in itself. I think certainly dual players should be cherished, but the environment has to be correct for it to continue within both camogie and ladies football. I think, look, with all the chat of integration, again, a bit like the players charter where the girls had played under protest this year, I do think it's the big one coming down with regard to the charter and making sure there's a master fixtures list so that at least we can protect them and make sure the environment is right. And if they want to make a decision to play ladies football over camogie or vice versa, at least let the environment be there to encourage dual players.
Absolutely. I'm open to correction, but I think Meath County Board have come out and said that they will certainly have fixtures that they won't clash, so hopefully other counties follow suit. Listen, final question to you, Aoife. We've chatted on a Wednesday evening about these dual player dilemmas, some cracking matches. We've had conversations over protests throughout the season. Ruby mentioned the record final attendance. When it's all said and done, how will Championship 2023 be remembered? Will it be in a positive light or a bit of a negative light or a changing light?
I would like to think changing light in the sense of, I think the character, the maturity that the players went about their business on both codes, Shane, on both ladies football and camogie, I think how they handled themselves during that protest, their willingness to play under it, you know, and they were the voices and the energy behind all of that. It was all because of the players just said, not going to take this anymore. And I think that's the changing light. And I think if you're Camogie or LGFA and you're sitting in your in HQ, you would start to look at these players going, we are now dealing with a different animal altogether. And I think that if I'm looking back at 2023, is you just saw so many more characters coming out from a leadership perspective, changing in the sense of players are going, no, I'm going to influence the next generation, and not just by my skill, but actually by my leadership on and off the pitch. So I think certainly changing and changing for the better.
Okay. Well, on that note, Aoife Murray, thank you very much indeed for taking the call this evening and our chats throughout the course of the Championship on a Wednesday evening. I'll let you go. Enjoy those Cork celebrations. I know you played it down, but you're still a Cork fan at heart, Aoife. So I appreciate you taking the call on the bank holiday evening. That was Aoife Murray, former Cork star. We're going to be hearing from jockey Sean Flanagan in a few moments' time.
Game on.
Racing.
Now, jockey Sean Flanagan has come through a rough spell in his career where so many things went against him over the past year, including breaking his back. He recently returned to the saddle and finished second in the Galway Hurdle on Thursday aboard Jesse Evans for his former boss, Noel Mead. During the Galway Festival, Flanagan spoke to Dave Keane about the challenges he's been facing.
It's been a frustrating year as regards. I'm riding a few winners away, but second in the English National and second in the Galway Hurdle. You know, under two races, funnily enough, I haven't actually watched back and I'm mulling them over in my head, and I haven't looked back yet, and sometime maybe I will, but look, it's brilliant to be taking part and riding horses with chances, but the year we're having is kind of a tough enough one to swallow at the same time.
But at the same time, when you roll back the clock, when you picked up that injury, you might just talk about what happened to you and the extent of that injury, because I remember seeing you in Navan in the latter part of last year and you were not in good shape.
No, I suppose there was a lot of things thrown in with it. I was just after coming out of a 7-year job, and it was the first time in a long time I'd found myself without the security of a yard of horses, and I'm not the type of fella that'll sit down and cry over it. I really got stuck in at the time, and I was riding out in loads of yards, and I was riding horses and getting confidence with the yards and the owners, I suppose. And I had a bunch of horses that I was kind of looking forward to riding, and then roll on the clock to just the start of the jump season in September in Thurles, and I got a fall, and I've done three ribs and three vertebrae, T4, 5 and 7. And
when you say done, you broke them?
Yeah, fractured them all. Now, they were stable fractures, so I didn't need any surgery or any of that, but I was in a brace for... So I was in a brace for 2.5 months, and then a kind of a month of rehab and back riding, you know, and... it was just such a really long time. Like, I missed all the start of jump season, and I missed Christmas as well, which is the first time in 18 years I'd missed Christmas, you know.
And out of sight, out of mind.
Well, very, very much so, and it couldn't happen that worst time where before, previously, I'd got plenty of injuries down through the years, and you walk back in and you have your yard of horses and your support from owners and that was gone. So it just has been like back to brass tacks and build again, you know. And look, I've ridden plenty of winners since the start of the season, and I said it at the start of at Punchestown the year before. I kind of said, right, we've lost the job and it's a new season, so let's go forward. And I found myself in Punchestown again this year saying the same thing. You know, we've had a bad run of injury and we've had a middling season, but let's try and build on it. And look, we're plenty of rides for plenty of different yards. But we're always playing second fiddle. There's somebody in every yard that I'm in that's stable jockey, and I'm only kind of picking up the spares. And hopefully we'll stumble across something that'll support us, you know.
I remember when I saw you that day in Navan, you said that you were in some pain when the brace was on. And just reflect back on that.
Yeah, look, I never, ever, from any of my injuries, I never took painkillers. It was just my method of it was, if you're too sore to do it, don't do it. And if you take painkillers, that muffles that pain and you end up doing more than you're able to do. So I, sillily enough, 2 days or whatever it was, a day, it was probably a day after I got out of the hospital, I was like, no, I'm not taking any painkillers, let's leave it. And 4 or 5 hours, I was on the phone to McGoldrick and requesting stronger painkillers. And I found myself like probably 6 weeks full-time, 3 times a day of painkillers. It was a pain that you just couldn't really get away from it. It's basically like a very bad toothache in your back, and there's just no getting away from it, you know. There was no sleep or no eating or nothing. It was just grind your teeth, I suppose.
But you have great distractions at home. You have a young family, I suppose. That keeps your mind occupied.
Yeah, absolutely. No, like, that was... Like, we just I suppose Livy was only... what was Livy? She was probably 6-7 weeks old at the time when I got hurt, and she was home and fine, and a day or two after I got hurt, she took quite a serious turn on us, and we did give the first 10 days of my rehabilitation, or my first 10 days after my accident, was spent at Temple Street, you know. And Temple Street Children's Hospital, you only think you're in bad shape until you find yourself in there. And I found myself in there with a broken back, and plenty of days that I've even forgotten it was broken. Now, the minute that the Livy started to improve, the back started to deteriorate a little bit again. It's amazing the way your body works. When there was someone that was kind of a bit more important down, you kind of go second nature to what's on the forehand. And but look, thankfully, she's bouncing around the place. She's nearly 11 months old now, and the back is all in the past.
But you're very much a glass half full type of fella. You're looking ahead now to the season. You're in Gavin Cromwell's, you're in Paul Nolan's, back riding a bit for Noel. You have plenty to look forward to, but it's a tough, tough place to be if you're not attached to the big yards over here.
It's next to impossible. I go to Peter Fahey's, and he's had a fantastic week here as well in Galway, but he does use Sam Ewan and he uses Kevin as well. And so, as I said, it's a very, very tight. Like, you go to Gavin's, you have Keith, and there's Kieran Buckley and Paddy O'Brien, and Danny goes in and I go in, and you know, and he's been very, very supportive. He's got a lot of horses in his yard that's going the right direction, as Paul Nolan's is. Like, Paul Nolan's is a yard that's probably 4 miles away from my home place, and until last season has never been in his yard. And it's just amazing, you know, the way things go. And I've ridden a couple of winners for him, and he's got a fantastic yard of owners and horses that are all going the right direction. And look at it, I'm in a better position as I was in this time last year, and you know, if we can get into the start of the jump season injury free, touch wood, it'll be something to look forward to.
You're just looking for the one.
That's all we're looking for, just one. Keep going to all the big yards and just looking for one.
Well, one is all anybody needs. Just getting on the right one is the hard part, but Sean Flanagan will not lack for endeavour or trying to find that one. An incredibly honest interview from him there, speaking at Galway last week about his injuries and, I suppose, a success that's going to come his way. He had plenty of it in the past and he will have it again. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for. We didn't get to soccer because, like plenty of you who are listening, I'm sure Alan Cawley is stuck on the M7 in that tailback. Hopefully those that were involved in that crash are okay. They looked alright when I was passing, so hopefully they are. We will have Alan Cawley on all the soccer on tomorrow evening's show. Better De Silva is up next. My thanks to Shane and Ronan Lawler. We'll chat tomorrow evening.